Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, it was our fault. We made a mistake. Spider said it was clear. I wasn't clear, and, you know, I didn't want to tear my car up, tear his car up either. I respect everybody, and I demand respect. And, you know, I apologized to the guy when he came over the car, explained to him what happened, and then he took it to another level when he started calling me an idiot and whatever else. And I don't appreciate that. I'm not going to take it. I told him how I feel. I called him out. He didn't show. You know, so, you know, I'm good with it if he's good with it, but I'm not going to be disrespected by no means.
Yeah, I guess I had a dinner date at Applebee's last night that I didn't find out until it was too late. It's a shame. Love their riblets and boneless wings, but...
All right, folks, welcome back to Meet Me at Applebee's, your unrefined racing podcast. I think that's what I'm going to stick with this season.
That's,
I think, unrefined.
Good.
It harkens back to Hooters. That was one of their first slogans. Yeah. Let's go with that.
Like, but, a raw mineral.
A mouthful of being unrefined.
A rock being pressed into a diamond, but it's not there yet.
Exactly. Perfect.
Phoenix and rising from the ashes.
Yes, but as always, it's Brian, Rob, and Ashley here to talk about the upcoming racing season that's about to start. Folks, how we doing this week?
Good. It's fucking here. It's happening.
Yes. Sunday, or technically Saturday, is the day when it all begins. Obviously, we're looking forward to that, and we'll talk a little bit about that towards the end of the show. Mm-hmm. But some stuff happened this weekend. Where do we want to begin?
Well, first, I just want to give a quick shout-out to a former guest and one of my good buddies who I mention, like, every episode, but Kyle Armstrong. It was his birthday this week. I fucking love that guy. He's one of my best racing buds. Great guy all around. Big supporter of my band. And we always have a great time together anytime we hang out, and he's been instrumental in me getting to have some amazing experiences at the racetrack. All over the fucking country. So shout out to you, Kyle. Happy birthday. I hope you had a good one. I know he did. He told me some stories that I'm not going to share on the show. But but they had a good time down in North Carolina celebrating Kyle's birthday. And I really appreciate you, bud. And I can't wait to see you in a few weeks when we play down in North Carolina. But that's the only thing I really want to have to talk about today. I can just log off now if you want. I just wanted to say hi to Kyle.
Oh, happy birthday, Kyle.
Yeah. So yep, in life, birthday, in life, though, there is also death, but we'll get to that later, I guess.
Yes, we will get to that later. I would say, so let's start out with this. The big news of the day, we're recording this on Tuesday, the long-awaited NASCAR Netflix series finally debuted. I don't even remember the actual name to this, and it doesn't really matter. I'm going to watch it anyways, but I know Ashley and I have not had a chance to watch it because it debuted at like 3 a.m. On our time. But Rob had a little more time today. I know he watched the entire thing.
I did.
And I'm going to give him like three sentences for a review because, A, we want to give everybody else listening to the show time to watch it. And, B, Ashley and I got to watch it. So we're going to save our full thoughts for next week. But, Rob, three sentences. Let's go.
That's okay. It's really well shot. If you're a diehard fan like the three of us are, there's no new information here. It focuses, you know, I don't want to say anything else. I want people to watch it with a clear head. I don't want to put any ideas out there. It's nice.
You're already at 3 cents.
Yeah. So. It's cool that it's on Netflix. And I will say that I don't think there's going to be, I can't imagine like a Drive to Survive level of new fans coming in. But it's cool that it's out there, and it's certainly the avenue that the last documentary series that was on USA, it's almost the exact same fucking show. It should have been on, that should have been on Netflix in the first place. That's pretty much my entire opinion of it. And yeah, we'll get into the details of it. There is some cool stuff on there, and I look forward to hearing what you guys have to say about it. But yeah, definitely check it out. It's only 5 hours in total, or less than that. It's like 5 episodes. They're all pretty short. I thought it was going to be longer than that, but yeah.
Yeah, you got plenty of time to get this all watched before the weekend, so I'm sure both of us will fire through this in the next few days, but I'm definitely looking forward to it, for sure.
They paint a nice picture, I'll say that.
Yeah.
It's supposed to rain all this weekend at the Clash, so...
Yeah, he might get a chance.
So I wonder if they'll run rain tires.
They are bringing rain tires to the Clash. So the problem is, and this is something that I don't know if I saw this on the internet, if it's my own independent thought, but it's definitely true. I don't know what kind of drainage they have down there. So you can run rain tires, but yeah. I don't know what happens. Where does the water go?
Chris said that they brought rain tires, but they're not bringing lights or windshield wipers or the flaps. So they can only run it in damp conditions like they did at North Wilkesboro. They won't run it in the actual rain.
Well, they don't do that anyway. So they can't run rain anyway, apparently.
Yeah. Well, I will imagine that there's probably some sort of drainage down there just for the football field itself. Like, you know, obviously it rains and they got to have places for water to go when it's just a field. So I would say there's probably something sorted out there. But either way, we'll talk more about the Clash towards the end of the show. Like I said, the Netflix show opened. In sponsorship news, let's talk about Ashley's favorite driver, Corey LaJoie.
Yeah, our rival. this puts fucking Corey LaJoie as our direct rival now. I hope you guys realize that.
100%.
He does. So Corey LaJoie got himself a sponsor for the 500, and that sponsor is Chili's. Now, I think I rarely eat in real life at both Applebee's and Chili's. I think I kind of like Chili's better, but in saying that, we're an Applebee's podcast. We have to say fuck Corey LaJoie and fuck Chili's.
We do, yeah.
So, it's Corey LaJoie. I don't expect him to do big things in the 500. He's not the greatest plate racer.
Corey's a good plate racer. What are you talking about?
Yeah, he almost won Atlanta.
Where's his wins? Oh, come on. Whatever.
I mean, I think if any place it could happen, it might be there. But yeah, a direct enemy of this podcast now. Fuck Stacking Pennies, which, by the way, is now on Sirius XM. That just got added to that lineup today. I haven't had XM for a little bit. They did some house cleaning. They got rid of Chocolate Myers' show. They got rid of Claire B. Lang and a couple others. That Mojo Nixon guy, which I never even listened to that show when I had XM, but they did some house cleaning, and one of the properties they added was Stacking Pennies. So good for Corey, but still, you're a direct enemy of this podcast now, and you are our competition, and we will crush you with our massive listenership and content this year.
Yeah, in 2024, the thing I'm most looking forward to is both of his teammates outrunning him all season long.
Yeah, which will 100%.
Both rookies. It's going to be great.
And speaking of sponsors, there's another team that's having some sponsor issues, apparently. Back in the news again, Colleague Racing. Colleague had most of their team sorted out, although there is a few open spots available for a driver that we cannot name just yet, because they also had some sponsorship issues. But Josh Williams was announced to be full-time in the car this year, the Xfinity car, and he was just reduced to a part-time schedule, again, due to sponsorship issues, which is really weird. Colleague was really, really hot up until, like, 2022, and I don't know what happened when they decided to start running Cup full-time, but seems like they've kind of been on the decline. I mean, AJ still wins races here and there, and I'd imagine he's going to do the same in Xfinity this year, but you know, it seemed like all the expansion they were doing in the growth years was only going to do them well. But looking into 2024, it's a weird picture over there.
Yeah. Well, when you have money, you can diversify. And it seems like a lot of the sponsorship opportunities that they did have dried up or have peeled back their involvement and that sort of thing. And it feels very transitional. I think they started off a lot hotter than people expected them to in Cup. You know, they got a couple wins through AJ Allmendinger. Justin Haley had some good runs. Now he's over at where the fuck he is? Rick Ware. Him and them Ware boys hanging out in the Chili's parking lot, smoking fucking crystal meth together or whatever it is they do. But the Xfinity program actually seems pretty strong at Colleague this year. Of course, AJ Allmendinger moving back full time to Xfinity Series to chase that title. That'll really help bolster that program. But the Cup end of things just seems really fucking weird. Josh Williams is doing a bunch of Cup races now, which wasn't part of the equation before. His first one being the Clash. Ty Dillon was supposed to be in there, but then he wasn't. They had a guy who was gonna fill in part-time in the 16 that we can't really talk about, but you can put it together if you listen closely. He's cried himself out of another job, it seems. So yeah, I don't know what the fuck they're gonna do, but I guess Josh Williams is the guy now, and for at least some of those open races. And they got Daniel Hemric full-time in the 31, right? So I don't know. It's just, if we're chasing trophies or whatever the fuck they call it, you know, not a great start. Not a good start at all. When Josh Williams is the really the only guy that when an unknown is your big gamble here, that's certainly something.
But a fan favorite.
For sure. And he's pretty good, too. You look at his stats, and this is the most important stat to me when you look at drivers that are in lesser rides and trying to prove themselves. It's the positions gained stat from where they start to where they finish. And Josh, on average, he generally was able to put that 92 car about 7 to 10 positions higher than where he started the race. So that bodes well, you know. But we've seen guys like Matt DiBenedetto do that, too. And then, you know, they kind of blow it. So I don't know. Like, who knows what's going to happen? But to me, the brightest spot in their entire Cup lineup is Josh Williams, which is not great, in my personal opinion. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I would like to see him do well.
Me too.
I like Josh.
He seems like a cool dude. But
yeah, I don't know. Again, I like Kolig. I like the attitude they have and just kind of the desire to win and the different chances they take on different guys. But yeah, it's a gamble. I guess we'll just see how it plays out.
It just feels like they're juggling too many balls at this moment.
It seems like they're spreading themselves thin or something. I don't know.
Yeah. They certainly have talented pieces, and they can win races. There's no in both Cup and Xfinity. But, I'm going to – I guess we'll save this for my little Clash preview. But, yeah, I don't see a whole lot of good coming out of the Cup into things next year, and I'll fucking eat the fucking – plastic container that the 99 bananas come in if any of those fuckers are able to do anything big time in that car.
You know, if AJ's at the roll, you might be
discounting AJ Allmendinger, because I've seen that
courses.
But yeah, strange times at Kolig.
Yeah, for sure.
In the back row of the RCR
campus. Strange times for strange people.
Yes.
Continuing in the news, Frankie Muniz, who I believe he's going to be full-time in ARCA this year again, right? I don't think he's changing where he's racing.
He's full-time
maybe some
in Xfinity.
Is he full-time in Xfinity? Am I getting that confused?
I don't know.
I thought
it was Xfinity.
I thought he didn't have money for Xfinity. Regardless, this isn't a...
He's got Malcolm in the Middle money.
Yeah, but he doesn't want to spend all that. You can't blow all your money on a race car. Regardless, this isn't about where
he's driving full-time. This is a recent announcement within the past month. He's driving full-time for Rhett Jones and ARCA. The big rumor going into this season that was he's going to be with DGM in Xfinity, I think, or SS Greenlight, one of the two. I can't remember which one. One of those sort of mid-tier teams, but it looks like that funding did not come together. I wouldn't be surprised to see him get an Xfinity ride once or twice this year. But, yeah, he's going. He's doubling down on the ARCA title this year. We'll see if he can do pretty well. He did fine last year, considering.
Yeah, I think maybe if he gets a couple wins this year, that'll really help move him along. I mean, he did well enough last year in his first season that you would hope that, you know, this year he pulls a couple out. But regardless, maybe if his new T-shirt sells really well, that'll help fund a ride, because
this is a great fucking T-shirt.
Friend of the show, Harris Liu, and his fiance Emily, they've been doing a lot of different freelance stuff for different drivers. They've been doing stuff for RFK, for Bubba, for Tyler Reddick, for a lot of different guys, and they actually just put out or designed a shirt for Frankie. And actually Emily, Harris's fiance, is the one that did this one. But it's basically just a portrait of his face. Yeah, if you look at the tag on the photo, Emily's tagged in it. She's the one who did it. But regardless, it's just a smiling portrait of Frankie Muniz's face, which for those who don't collect as much older T-shirts, 80s and 90s, there were lots of different T-shirts that had drivers' faces on them. Some that were just literally the drivers' faces themselves. I've seen those with like Bill Elliott and Harry Gantt,
just
and
looking at this fucking
Richard
thing right
Petty
now.
And stuff. And yeah,
it's
that's
like
what
like a Mills vibe to it.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
I have a Vince Gill shirt that looks very similar to this. Just a giant face and some whatever fucking script that is. You know.
I've got one of Davey and one of petty.
Yeah. If that shirt was made in the 90s, you can certainly, you know, that screen print weighs 5 additional pounds. And
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's hot. Yeah, it's a good shirt. I didn't know that the Harris family designed that, though, so good for them. More quality shit with the good design on the front of the shirt. Always much appreciated. I wouldn't want that Frankie Muniz face in my back. that's for sure. I think Brian is, he got so upset.
He's adding that shirt to his cart right now.
He's currently adding all sizes. And if you want Brian to buy you one, just send him a message on Instagram at Speedway Screens and let him know what your size is, and he'll get that to you as soon as possible. Yeah.
Your mailing address.
Yeah, and he'll ask your address. Yeah. He's got a whole thing he has to go through with you, some criteria. But he'll buy you a Frankie Muniz t-shirt, and it'll be cool. He's just gone.
Wow. Murphy's still talking.
He might be, listen, but
buy your own goddamn, Frankie Muniz shirts.
Generous Brian. He's turning, it's his New Year's resolution this year to just be kind to everybody. Yeah. That's how he's doing it, is by buying Frankie Muniz t-shirts for everybody. So,
yeah, absolutely. moving on to some slightly sadder news. Last week we had to talk about the passing of the legendary Cale Yarborough, and this week we have another, I don't know if legend's exactly the word to describe him, but I would say just a NASCAR enigma. Yeah, infamous is one way. The infamous L.W. Wright, the driver that
allegedly,
basically more or less stole a car and then disappeared into the night after crashing out of a Talladega race. It was discovered a couple years ago by longtime NASCAR journalist Rick Houston. It took him years to find LW, but he finally did. And, you know, he did an exclusive interview. And Rick, I know, has been shopping this around a little bit. He wants to turn it into either a book and or a movie. And, you know, I know he's had talks with different people, but that's why that story is not out there. The complete story is not out there. He's only let out little snippets. And unfortunately, due to people like Mike Davis not believing it's LW Wright, some of the fan base doesn't believe that's actually LW, but the fact that anyone would try to discredit someone with literal decades of motorsports writing, and he's had works published outside the motorsports industry. If you think a guy like Rick is not going to vet this source and vet this person as the real LW, you're fucking insane. It's unfortunate that his story did not make it out to the public before he passed, but hopefully one day we all hear the real true story, because it's one of those things that, you know, if you're a NASCAR fan for years, this was just one of those stories that you heard about and couldn't believe it ever happened, and for years no one ever thought this guy would ever turn up, but he did, and unfortunately he passed. So,
some of those details did make it out. I don't know if it was on Scene Vault or if
It was Scene Vault.
I know there was an episode where they didn't say a whole lot about what he did after that, but apparently he worked in the garage for a couple of teams after all that went down.
Yeah, there's some mixed stories, and again, like, we don't know exactly what happened.
And it's a shame that we can't know. I know what Rick's trying to do, but I can understand why people are unwilling to accept that version of the truth, you know, just because he can't tell all of them because he's trying to maximize on it. So I get it. It just sucks. But I agree with you. It's too bad that story didn't get to be fully told while LW was still alive.
Yeah. And unfortunately, one thing Rick does say is, like, he was not a good person. He in the little obituary that he wrote about him, he said there were two different LWs. There was Larry, who was a great person, and that's the guy that he first met, and then there's LW, the guy, the con man, the guy who's done all sorts of bad things, and the guy that deserved to be in prison. So,
bad dog.
Condolences to those who care about LW, and hopefully someday we get to hear the full story.
And if you don't know what this is about, just please Google it. It is an incredible little piece of NASCAR folklore. It's certainly the D.B. Cooper story of the racing world. And there was a lot of weird things that happened around that time. The Mario Rossi story was kind of within the same decade, too. That's another weird one. All the drug money coming in and sports car racing. There's a lot of wild shit that went on kind of under the radar in those days. And this story is certainly one of the weirdest of all. So I would recommend looking into that.
Yeah, for sure. Unfortunately, though, it's not the only bit of tragedy that we have to talk about from this past weekend. As we all know, the Rolex 24 went down to Daytona this past weekend, and the race itself is one story, but the other story.
You should have led with that, huh? That's a pretty major fucking event.
I wanted to transition this. So the other story that came out of this race was prior to the start of the race. You have to refresh my memory as to which driver it was, but somebody's puppy got run down in the parking lot of the track.
DeFrancisco or whatever his name is.
According to Jenna Fryer, this apparently was a pretty big to-do on pit road before the race, which I can kind of get. If a puppy, you only have a puppy for so long, you can't get that connected to it. I mean, obviously you're bummed out if your pet gets killed before the race, but like, I don't know, man, it's only a puppy. You've only had it for a couple of weeks. Geez. But and I'm a dog person saying this, so but in saying that also, the guy who killed it was Chip Ganassi. Yeah. And that was another that was another thing that came out.
There's
after
the wrinkle
fact.
Right there.
Yeah.
I heard that and I was like, God, I hope it wasn't on that little fucking scooter he rides around the paddock. That would have been
I
so
hope
bad.
It was.
Here comes Chip. But yeah, sad.
Chip Ganassi killed a dog at the Rolex 24. But then a race happened, and I didn't watch a whole lot of it, but I know, Rob, you had it on. Assuming Ashley probably had it on here and there, maybe. But
a little here and there.
It was good. Usually I tune into the whole event a little bit more and pay a lot more attention, but I don't know. There's a lot of late model racing going on, and it's a lot easier to tune into the short track stuff that's happening right now. So I honestly forgot it was even going on up until like a few days before. So I did not have the attention span for it that I usually do. But congratulations to Roger Penske and Joseph Newgarden and all those guys for getting a win. Big year for both of those guys. Of course, Joseph Newgarden winning the 500. The Milt Gimp taking his good luck streak all the way to Daytona too. And also, of course, the captain getting a big win there. Everyone likes to see that. Great battles throughout the field. I think I say this every year about the 24. It's amazing to me that they can run a 24-hour race and the deltas from first to second and all the classes are generally so tight. We get NASCAR-style battles now, which is fucking nuts for 24 hours, so... It's a great event. It's definitely on my list of things to do. I couldn't tell you much more about it than that, so I don't want to talk too much more about it. All I know is that Chip Ganassi killed a dog and Roger Penske got a trophy. So,
well, the other
that's pretty much it.
I saw that Brad Pitt was there filming his F1 movie.
That's right. They were filming.
They were doing
as well.
That. The only thing that I can really note, I mean, I'm not really a sports car guy. It's cool. Like, the cars are cool, but I don't know. It's just very low on my list of racing to try to figure out. But I will say I had it on, for the last couple hours, and the finish was really fucking bizarre. Like, they called for the
IMSA fucked up.
Yeah, they called for the white flag and then immediately the checkered flag. Like just within seconds of each other. I was like, what the fuck was that? And I think they still had like a minute left on the clock, and I saw something about, you know, if the checkered flag is displayed improperly, regardless of whether it should be displayed. Like, it still counts as the finish.
Yeah,
I don't
know. There's that NASCAR ownership coming in there, basically saying, like, yeah, we fucked up, but we make the rules, so the race was over with the checkered flags, which I guess is the easiest and most diplomatic way to handle that. I don't think that the Cadillac guys would have had any chance to catch up with the Penske boys, but I don't think it really changed much of anything. But still, that's a bad deal. That's not a great look, especially when you had such a great race leading up into that, which, again, for all intents and purposes. Maybe I missed something, but to me that seemed like another great race, and if it wasn't so damn long, I would go back and watch it. But just the highlights for me, please. But I do recommend checking it out. there's always a lot of fun characters out there racing. Bubba Wallace was out there as far as NASCAR guys were concerned.
No, he wasn't in the F24. He was in the race the day before.
Yeah, he was in the Pilot Challenge.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
I'm trying to. I feel like
there's fewer NASCAR guys than normal. Usually, yeah, you'll see like Kyle Larson out there, or you know, something like that. But
for that 4-hour thing, it was just Bubba and John Hunter and Corey Heim. But in the 24 hours, there weren't any NASCAR guys except they kept talking about that Connor Zilich or whoever that track house just signed.
Getting the overall win.
Yeah, I don't know.
Good for him.
Yeah. But yeah, great race. So watch it next year. I didn't really this year.
Yeah.
As much as I wanted. So.
So from the big track to the small tracks, as Rob said, there was some short track stuff going on this weekend. And I know the first note, the RTJ versus Jonathan Davenport, I did see some clips about this, and I'll let you take away, but I will say Davenport did seem like a little bit of a baby in what I saw. So, Rob, let's hear it.
I think it depends on your age and tax bracket for who you're pissed at about that. Of course, they're racing down in Florida now. Like, Speed Weeks is pretty much started for the short track world. There's Sprint Cars at Volusia. There's a big deal going on at East Bay. There's Modifieds racing this week down there. The dirt ones, of course. By the way, Kyle Strickler picking up a nice little win at East Bay. So good for him. The high side tickler. Got shit-faced with him at Eldora. Good guy. But the big story of the week was over at Golden Isle. The Lucas Oil Late Model Series kicked off their season for the year. 2024, the year of our Lord. And I don't even know where to start with this. The racetrack was kind of dog shit. It was very one lane, tough to pass, which that happens sometimes. You know, it is what it is. It's dirt track racing. Sometimes the track sucks. But anyway, RTJ ended up getting into the back of Jonathan Davenport and jacked him up pretty good. Mike Marler kind of chopped RTJ later in the race, and he kind of moved him out of the way too. And then there was, I wouldn't call it egregious, but it was certainly opportunistic of RTJ to take the inside line like he did on Jonathan Davenport, which got Davenport jacked up. I guess they made contact with their the right front or whatever, and sent Davenport up the hill, and that caused Brandon Shepherd to be able to get by both of them. And then right after that happened, or a few laps later, the caution came out, and RTJ was able to get his position back, and he ended up winning the race. So not a lot of happy people in that whole situation. On the podium, Jonathan Davenport gave RTJ a nice little elbow in the ribs, and then Ricky Thornton just smiled because he just won $25,000. But, man, like, what is it with Georgia racing fans being so salty on the Internet? These fuckers.
What are you talking about?
It's like Chase Elliott fans. I'm not including you in this number, True Love. You're exempt from this, but some of your countrymen.
Listen, they every are NASCAR fan base has off. Salty fans. I didn't even hear about any of this.
Oh, it depends on what.
Or see the clip.
On Facebook, they're fucking mad. And Jonathan Davenport's mad. Again, like, as far,
never get on Facebook.
I'm a fan of both guys. I think Jonathan Davenport fucking rules. He's a super nice guy. He's a great race car driver. He's cool as fucking. Takes no bullshit. Whatever. I like RTJ a lot, too. I think he's the future. He's also a nice guy. I have no fucking skin in this game. You know, I actually very much enjoyed it. I like to see Ricky win. People are just talking about, you know, both of them being babies, you know, and whining and blah, blah, blah. Apparently, open your mouth and having an opinion is whining these days. But I don't see why you wouldn't want two of the top drivers in a fucking series to not like each other very much and race each other hard, because that's just, there's like 400 races a year in late model racing. And if they carry this through the year, we're in for one hell of a show. So I guess that's my whole take on that thing. Ricky Thornton taking home a big check. And good for him. Hopefully he'll make some more cool t-shirts for me to buy, because again, I'm a big RTJ fan. But yeah, that's pretty much the whole short track story of the weekend. But I am here for the drama. A lot of people upset that they're even bringing up this story and talking like the media is making this happen. I don't know, like, what the fuck do people want? Don't you want something exciting to watch? And if it means door slamming, I guess I'll take it in this case. Anyway.
Yeah, that's. I mean, nobody got wrecked. They just kind of moved each other out of the way.
Because like, they're both so fucking good at what they do. It's awesome.
Yeah.
It's late model racing. What the fuck do you expect? But I don't know. I know there's people who probably disagree with me on that one, but that was pretty much the only real big to-do of the weekend. Of course, they're going on to Ocala, which used to be called Bubba Motorsports Park. And then Speed Weeks continues. And next week, we got Modifieds, and all the new Smyrna shit kicks off. Lots of racing coming up in the next few weeks, so the short track septic tank will be a slightly longer segment. Our donor for the week does come from the short track world. I don't even know what this... I think it was like Jade Avedisian's golden ticket post. Have you guys seen this shit on the internet? All the TRD drivers are like finding golden tickets in their mailbox. It's like videos of them like Buddy Kofoid's like pulling his out of the trash or some shit like that. I don't know. Like
I didn't see that one.
But like uncovering it from dirt. And at first I thought it was like a high limit thing. I was like, oh fuck, because Christopher Bell got one too. I was like, oh, is he gonna run high limit with these guys? Holy shit. No, it's just some TRD thing. I don't know what it's about. Because Bubba Wallace is involved. Yeah, it's their like 100,000th anniversary or some shit. So it's. Certainly tied in with that.
The caveman era.
Yeah, they've been making oil for a long time. Yeah. They owned the dinosaurs back in the day. But the Darf of the Week comes from Jade Avedisian's post from this guy named Rick on Twitter, or X. He says, awesome, with 2 exclamation points. Sorry if I startled you coming out of the ladies' room with the chili bowl with your girl posse. Guess I was just surprised. Time and place, huh? Good luck, Jade. And... there's just no reason to say that. So there's literally no reason to bring that up. So there's no real sentence this week other than I'm going to give you 5 minutes to sit quietly and think about what you did and maybe reconsider your etiquette on Twitter.
Within 500 yards of a women's restroom.
She's like 17 years old.
Oh, boy.
That's my dart for the week. But... Yeah, that's pretty much it. Like I said, there's lots of short track racing coming up in the next few weeks. If you have an illegal stream of Flow Racing, of Dirt Vision, of Racing America, all that shit, there's so much coming up alongside Speed Weeks at Daytona or Speed like Day, since they only run like 3 days down there now for trucks and Xfinity and Cup and all that. But lots of racing to dig into. Speed Weekend, that's perfect. Brought to you by Mobile One's 400,000th anniversary. But... there'll be more to talk about next week, but that's the septic tank. So we can go ahead and roll the flushing noise. That's it. Yeah.
So this is our first real video of the week segment for this season. And it was a long one, but again, with no racing to get into this week, you know, I figured we'd run a long one because next week we're going to have a lot to talk about.
This is a great fucking video. Great.
Yeah, I love this video so much. It was so good.
I've said this a few times in the show. This might be my favorite one that we've done.
I think it's definitely up there just because it's so broken up and it's not just racing footage and it's long, but you see a lot of different stuff.
And it's a nice window into what motorsports television coverage was back in the 80s.
So this show, Inside NASCAR, I honestly don't even remember where it was shown or what. I don't know if this was like syndicated or on like early TNN or if it was just like a video series.
I think it was on ESPN, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
Okay, yeah, because this is, I mean, I looked briefly for episodes and couldn't really find much, but this whole edit feels like it was a VHS tape that was released just by how it's all spliced together, but... it's an hour and a half long, and it is the best of segments from Inside NASCAR. And again, a lot of what they showed was behind-the-scenes stuff and personality pieces and technical stuff, and you really get a good mix of all of that stuff in these, how many segments? 15 different segments here. And to start it off, we go down to Dawsonville and do a little story on Bill Elliott, who at the time, I mean, 85... you know, he didn't win the title that year, but he won just about everything else. And this was filmed middle of the year, around the 600. You know, there's not a whole lot of depth here. It's really kind of depth as far as like you don't learn again. You don't learn anything new. What I'm into is the aesthetics of all this and seeing. The house, I guess the main thing you learn about that I caught was like seeing the house that he lived in 85, which is just like a little ranch house there. In the middle of nowhere. I'm assuming it's still there. Does any of the family still live there? Probably not, right?
No, they're abandoned and like the grass is growing up in them, but they're still right next to the property.
Also, the shop. Real quick, you get to see a very young Steve Burns throughout this entire thing. And that's fucking awesome. Him and Ned Jarrett just being, you know, it's a very young Steve Burns before he's the Steve Burns we all grew to respect. And then, of course, Ned Jarrett just being, you know, just being Ned. It's awesome. But anyway, continue.
Wearing great jackets.
Great jackets, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he this is Bill, you know, he was emerging as a superstar at this time, and you really kind of see how humble and how quiet of a guy he is in these moments, and how, you know, he doesn't like being on camera, doesn't like being interviewed, all this stuff. And it was neat. You know, Ashley, as the Elliot super fan here, I feel like you should get the final word on this little segment.
Oh, I love this segment. This is by far my best part of this whole video.
All right, well then tell me why, again, as all the Bill Elliott stuff, what was your favorite part here?
I love how dangerously close they're sitting to that busy road.
Yeah, you can hear the cars going by the whole fucking time. Oh, it's great.
If you drive by the shop now, like, that's the main road right there, and it's just flying up and down the whole time they're interviewing, like, right next to it. But Ernie gives an interview, which you never hear Ernie give interviews because he's the most reserved of the Elliots.
Yeah.
And then there's a Dan interview, and he's, you know, I'm not gonna lie, Dan's it's kind of a little hottie.
Oh. The truth comes out.
The truth out of the Elliott boys. Dan's
I would say he's the most handsome out of the three, for sure. No doubt about it.
For sure.
Is that the garage? Is it still there? Do they still own it? Like, what's there?
Yeah, Ernie still does like his engine shops out of it.
Oh,
it's cool. Still, so yeah.
Cool. Any other final
notes?
There's
an interview with Bill's ex-wife, Martha. I've never heard her speak before either. She didn't really have much to say, but
classic.
one thing I will say was funny is she was hoping that once racing was over, they'd be able to enjoy all the spoils that they've earned in these crazy times. But unfortunately, she didn't make it that far, did she?
No, they got divorced a few years later.
I was gonna say she probably was able to enjoy some of those spoils when she was divorced, but not with Bill.
No,
none of the ski trips with the young Chase later on, which. There's a video of that out there too. There's like some Elliott documentary that came out later on. There's like a young Chase running around, but I'm sure we'll watch that on here eventually.
Yeah. The next segment is pretty much almost the exact opposite. We go from one of the top teams in the sport that's winning everything to a guy that's doing it all by himself. Ronnie Thomas. He was.
This is my favorite segment out of all this.
This is Rob's favorite segment. We'll all get to our favorite segment at some point. But, Ron, this is like a nice little interview with Ronnie Thomas. Ronnie, you know, again, 78 Cup Rookie of the Year. At this point in the time, he was one of the few guys, was an independent driver. I mean, obviously, Dave Marcus is probably the most well-known independent driver. But Ronnie was up there with him. And really, this was just a behind-the-scenes piece on the struggle of what it takes to run a team without sponsorship. You know, as they document in the video, Ronnie was basically doing everything himself. Yep. His dad was helping him set up the car, and, you know, he'd have people come to the track with him to help pit and stuff, but he was pretty much doing it all himself as far as managing the quote-unquote team and getting the car together and all that. And, you know, he's 30 years old in this clip. He's got very cherubic look to his face and this nice little curly afro, which I thought was funny. He talks about getting older and...
He could be 15 or he could be 50 in this video. There's really... If he didn't tell you, there's no way of knowing, so...
Yeah.
No.
And he does... towards the end of this segment, he does the thing that a lot of... underfunded drivers say that, you know, if I was in Waltrip's car, I'd show him, that type of deal, which you know, who knows, but he unfortunately never was able to show him. His career didn't last too much longer, although he is still with us. I mean, he's only 68 years old. I know he's been on the scene vault. I know he's restored at least one of his race cars and goes and displays it and stuff, so there's a chance he'll run into Ronnie at a track somewhere in the south, so good for him. And they do actually, later on in the video, they offer an update, because Ronnie mentioned he's getting older and fatter. Well, apparently after this segment was filmed, he saw himself on TV and went and lost 30 pounds. So good for him.
Good for him.
I enjoy his accent too. The way he said "terrible."
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, he was. It was good, and I do remember listening to his Scene Vault interview, and it was very entertaining. So go check that out. I think it was a couple years ago that he was on the show now, but well worth checking out.
Absolutely. And the reason why I love this segment so much is it's a nice sort of glimpse into, as you already said, Brian, what it was like to be somebody, a have-not in the garage, if you will. And it was kind of cool to see the sort of parallels between then and now, because it's a lot of the same lines being said by, like, you know, you hear like Tommy Joe Martins or somebody like that talk about what it's like to struggle at the back half of the Xfinity Series garage or the middle, whatever, just trying to make it without sponsorship and do everything on your own. A lot really hasn't changed, but what has changed is just the level of technology and how this, you could have asked the street stock guy from Stafford the same questions. He probably would have said some of the same things he said in this interview. So it was definitely a fascinating little window into what the back of the grid looked like and what it was like to really scrape by back in the days before all that money was there. So yeah, the similarities are definitely pretty striking though. And I just very much enjoyed watching him. Again, my favorite part about it was him talking about if he had the money, how he could go out there and do it. It's like all these fucking races are exactly the same.
Corey LaJoy syndrome.
The same people who are putting weights into marshmallows at the Chili Bowl are the same ones out there running, always trying to make it better. If I had just a little bit more, you fucking watch. And I love that so much. It just embodies the spirit of short track racing and stock car racing in general. So, yeah, I loved this little segment. And it was kind of cool to see it right after that Bill Elliott one, too. I'm sure that was a deliberate choice
for sure.
By the curator to show those two disparities back-to-back. But, yeah, really fucking cool to see. Because you don't really hear a lot about the sort of independent owner-operators in that time as much as you do the legends like Cale Yarborough or Bill or, you know, any of those guys. Like, that's all well-documented. But guys like him, you don't see much of that. So I really enjoyed getting an opportunity to see somebody who didn't have the money and their struggles trying to make it.
Yeah. Anything to add, Ashley, before we move on?
I think I'm good, unless y'all want to talk about Bill Elliott some more.
We'll get to that later, I guess. We'll circle to back.
Later on. Now, next up, I would say out of this entire hour and a half video, the most historic footage to appear. You get a brief interview with Wendell Scott himself. Now,
I don't think I've ever seen a Wendell Scott interview before.
That's the thing, is I don't think I've ever heard him talk before, ever, or seen any video footage of him.
Which is crazy, since NASCAR talks so much about him now. I'm surprised that this footage hasn't, you know, made it out in the world.
I've seen these clips before. The Wendell Scott Foundation is pretty good about posting old footage on their Instagram.
Oh, really? Them, but not NASCAR. Yeah. You'd think.
let's dive into that. So, again, this clip, it's the first time we've all kind of seen Wendell talk, and they do a little interview at his house. One thing I'll say while we're talking about this segment is the background music for this entire video was really all over the fucking place. And in this one, there's a lot of like weird 80s like instrumental stuff or like smooth jazz. In this particular segment, there's some smooth jazz going on in the background, but it's mixed really high. You can almost barely hear what the hell Wendell's saying half the time.
Yeah.
Which, when we get into what he's talking about, I don't think this was necessarily done on purpose, but if it was, I also wouldn't necessarily be surprised. You know, Wendell's story.
You can
story,
roll the dice on that one.
Yeah. Wendell's story, I mean, he was the first black driver in NASCAR to win a race, and, you know, that race was taken away. That win was briefly taken away from him. But before that even happened, the whole impetus of Wendell getting in a race car was there was a track nearby called Dixie Speedway, I guess, that was trying to get more black drivers involved in the sport. And their way of doing this, because there just weren't any around, was to go to the local police station and ask them if there were any black guys with speeding records. And Wendell Scott was the name that the police gave him. So that's how he got involved in motorsports. Now, in saying that, his dad was also a renowned mechanic in the area. So he was around cars and he liked cars his whole life. So it's not like he had zero knowledge of what he was getting into. He just, you know, had raced up until that point.
And there was definitely a sort of and this is something I'd love to learn more about, but there was sort of a Negro League back in the day of stock car racing that you don't really hear a whole lot about.
Yeah, I think I have briefly heard. Kind of like there was a women's league, too, that you don't really hear much about either. So that kind of makes sense. Actually, before we get to the butt part, now, Ashley, was the car that Wendell was talking in front of, was that the same car that you saw? Or did he have maybe a couple cars on his property and... You know, I couldn't tell from that angle. You couldn't tell if that was a smashed up one or not.
I'm going to be honest. I didn't notice what car he was sitting in front of. I was struggling so hard to listen to him over that jazz music.
Through the jazz.
Yeah. And maybe here's why. So, obviously, we all kind of know the story of what happened to Wendell. He won in Jacksonville in 63, and the officials gave it to Buck Baker because they didn't want a race riot to start. And... Wendell talks about this. Now, one thing I actually learned from this that I didn't know before is that he actually won like 128 sportsman races, you know, prior to winning the cup race, which is great. And I don't know how I didn't know that. But
he didn't suck. Yeah, he didn't, no question he didn't about suck. It.
He was friends with Richard Petty. He got a lot of stuff from the Petties and you know, he was another independent. But when Wendell gets into telling the story of what happened, they don't really tell the story at all. He just kind of talks about how he never thought he'd win a race, and then he did, and then he thought he was going to lose it, and then that's the end of the segment. Like, they kind of talk about how he won the race and that they said Buck Baker did, but I knew I won, and then that's it. They don't explain why the race was taken away. They don't explain why they gave it back to him. They don't explain any of this shit. And again, this is 1985. I don't want to say I can understand why they didn't want to bring that stuff up, you know, but it was startling to see his story told that way.
I mean, to put it in perspective, though, all of those things happened maybe 20 years earlier.
Yeah, that's, I guess.
So when you put time in perspective, like, the civil rights movement was not that long ago in 1985.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, shit, that's the other crazy thing to think about.
Which is wild. But yeah. He didn't get his trophy, the actual trophy for that race, until not that long ago.
Yeah, the family finally got it, so. So, yeah, I would say if somehow you don't want to watch this whole video by the time we're done talking about it, at the very least, go back and watch. It's only a couple minutes. It's well worth your time.
This video is also very nicely segmented, so you can kind of skip around to the different things you want to watch. So if there's something that we're talking about you don't give a fuck about, guess what? You can figure out what to skip pretty easily. It's all time-stamped, so.
I just rewound it to this part, so I'm going to see if I can spot the car.
Yeah, it's the last like few seconds of the segment. But the next segment features Richard Petty and Dale Lehman, who for the 1986 season, I guess, they were joining back up at Petty Enterprises. I mean, there was a split a few years prior, and then 85 was like the first year Richard didn't win anything. So in 86, Dale decided to come back. But this segment really has hardly anything to do about racing, because it is Richard and Dale go to a Redskins game. Now, forgive me for using that team name, but regardless, that's what they were, who they were going to see in 1985. Now, I didn't know Richard was a big football fan or anything, but they talk about how big of fans they are. And I guess the one thing that I found interesting is Richard's favorite team being the Redskins, or the Washington Football Club. What are they called now?
Commanders.
Okay. Commanders. Richard's favorite team was the Commanders. So is Dale Jr.'s. I don't know. Is there some North Carolina connection there with that team? Like, well, just curious.
The Panthers weren't around until a lot later, and I feel like that might have something to do with it. Washington being sort of the closest. Maybe I'm wrong about the geography there.
When did Gibbs get involved with that team?
Gibbs, they started racing in the mid late 80s is when Joe Gibbs started showing up, and Joe Gibbs Racing was the early 90s, I believe, when they really started.
I think she's asking when he got.
Oh, the Redskins, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I don't fucking know. I'm not a football guy, so.
But he won a bunch of championships and shit by the time he started playing around in NASCAR.
Oh, yeah, he was already a well-known guy. Yeah. But regardless, it was, you know, if you're a football fan...
Help us out, folks. Yeah, shoot us a message.
Whatever. it's an interesting little clip. There's a very funny little two-second clip of a guy talking to Richard and telling him he was, like, you're
drunk,
the best
drunk ever. Guy.
Yeah, drunk-ass guy getting his autograph. And you know, Richard kind of talks about, he compares the growth of NASCAR to the growth of other more traditional sports, and how, you know, NASCAR in 1985 is seemingly finally approaching that level of status, at least on the East Coast then. And yeah, we were, nobody knew how much bigger it was going to grow in the years to come, but again, we were on the ascent in 1985.
Yeah, the pre-Intimidator days.
Yeah.
So.
Which there's no Earnhardt footage in this video. Just a quick,
yeah, hardly anything.
Quick aside. But again, you see plenty of Earnhardt shit. I'm kind of more into this weird stuff you never see.
I enjoyed this little football segment the most, yeah, because Richard and Dale Inman have incredible style in this. They are dressed like absolute badasses.
That's a fact.
Yeah, that is true.
That's a fact.
And you know, Richard, he still has his look to this day.
Still got the same wardrobe from back in the day.
Yep. Now next up is a look back at the Daytona Beach track, and I mean, there's not a whole lot to talk about with this segment. I mean, it's beach stories. One thing that happens a couple times in this video, and it might just be because of it being edited from larger segments, is some of the people, the talking heads, aren't introduced at all. Like, there's some guy on the screen with a very, like, almost ship captain-looking facial hair mustache going on. Looks like a fucking pirate to me. I don't know who it is, but he's talking about being at those races. And then they show Tim Flock, who...
This is cool. Yeah.
This was the cool part. So they talk about the end... He talks about the end of the Speedway Beach course, and he says it was because that area was expanding with hotels and houses and stuff. And the way he described it was like people were just walking in and out of their houses and like crossing the racetrack to go to the beach while the race was fucking happening. Because he talks about like drunk guys wandering onto the track and people going to get their mail and shit. And it's just like, what the fuck?
It's like some rally shit.
Yeah. So that was interesting, and you know, there's plenty of beach footage out there. I don't think you really learn much other than the Tim Flock info there. But yeah.
Footage is always so cool to me, and especially as we enter a new season and we're about to go to Daytona, it's nice to get that reminder of where all of this shit came from.
Yeah.
And that footage is always so fascinating to me. That's where it all came from. Was literally racing on a fucking beach. I wish I could have been alive to have seen that, or I wish there was some way that NASCAR could try and do that again. There's no way it would ever happen, but like it'd be really cool to see them do a nod like that. But
even an exhibition, have a couple guys come out and just do a couple laps.
Let that be the fucking Clash from now on. How about that, huh? Yeah. Super cool though. Anytime you get to see that footage is a treat, and this is a nice collection of it. And again, hearing Tim Flock talk about just his stories from that era is fascinating shit. So
yeah. Next up, we take a trip to Harry Rainier's Thoroughbred Farm. Now,
yes,
for those who are unaware, Harry Rainier was one of the two owners of Rainier Lundy Racing, which was Cale Yarborough's team, and also Davey Allison's first team, which later became Robert Yates Racing. I didn't really know anything about that team, like the owner. I didn't know anything about their horse racing background. It just was one of those things I never learned. And
this is the first time I'd ever actually seen any sort of long form interview about it. I knew about it, but I'd never heard it being discussed in tandem with the NASCAR shit, so that was cool.
The farm is called Calumet Farms, and it produced all sorts of winners of Triple Crowns and all sorts of shit. And they show this horse called Aladar, which was another one that I guess in 78 finished second in all the Triple Crown races, and now he's like $150 million stud horse. That's what they valued him at, which is fucking insane to
think
about.
Potential future for Daniel Hemric, you know, finishing second as much as he does. So.
Yeah, there you go. And then JT Lundy, he compares race cars to horses in the sense that you know, if you break a horse, you can go home and put it out to pasture to stud, but you can't breed a race car. But in saying that, you can't feed a race car either. So I guess they both have their pluses and minuses when it comes to the upkeep.
Oh, that is real expensive.
Yeah.
What I took out of that.
And I guess the only other real thing to note is, you know, they make a couple goals for the team. One of them is to run a full-time season, which they hadn't. You know, you think back to, I can't remember if it was 83 or 84, but Cale Yarborough won. He was in 16 races and won four of them. Like, that was the capability of that team. And Cale, at that point in his career, and he'd already won three titles, he didn't want to run full-time anymore. They had the money. They could have run more races, and eventually they did with Davey Allison. But those are their two goals. The two goals were that and to win the Southern 500, which, of all the things they did, that was the one race they never won.
Yeah. Well, that was more of a common old school attitude back in those days, because a lot of guys didn't run full. Like, David Pearson didn't run full time very often, and he's a legend. You know,
it's a very weird thing to think about in these modern times when, you know, I would say 5, 6, 7 years after this video was filmed, if not less than that, if you weren't running full time, like, you know, what the hell are you doing out there?
Yeah, exactly.
And now this next handful of segments are all going to be kind of behind-the-scenes tech stuff. And also, again, just it's a time capsule back. This is almost 40 years ago. And if you kind of wonder how the sport progressed to where it is now, this segment pretty much shows you the start of where all the crazy expenses came when it come to the technological side of the cars. And we start off with a trip to the wind tunnel. Now, in 1985, there were only a couple wind tunnels in the U.S. at all. They get into the finances of all of it and what it goes into building one of these facilities, and there's this massive, like, propeller that was like millions of dollars. But when they actually show footage of the car being you know, measured or gauged, whatever the fuck you want to call how you use a wind tunnel, the guy's like just got this little handheld almost fire extinguisher looking thing, and it's just like very it wasn't the wind tunnel footage I was used to seeing from the 90s where you know, people are standing behind the glass and like looking at computer monitors and stuff. This was the very beginning.
This is the genesis of that. Yeah, it's very primitive, and it's crazy to see what they're able to do with these fucking square body Buicks and shit like that. It's awesome.
Next up, we get a trip to the Bell Helmet Factory, which...
This is cool.
This clip starts out absolutely amazing with the designer setting up an experiment to test the strength of this helmet. And they have this not quite guillotine-looking contraption set up to test the helmet, but... they use a very dramatic slow motion shot where they cut the camera about 6 times, showing this helmet slowly and dramatically falling onto this block where it's going to be smashed. Love that. Absolutely love that. And
come a long way, folks.
Yeah. A few different behind the scenes clips of, like, you know, stress testing the straps and the helmets themselves getting made, because they were all made in the U.S. at the time. So this was, even back then, there were very few drivers with full face helmets. I mean, you saw Bill Elliott with his almost motocross style Simpson helmet in the beginning. Jeff Bodine was another early adopter of the full face, but most guys were still running open faces at the time.
Jeff Bodine was one of the first guys to really get into the safety aspect of it.
Yes.
Coming from the modifieds, like building custom seats and all that. Like, he was one of the first guys to really think about that, and definitely an early adopter of some of the technology we see now.
Mm-hmm. Next up,
one more thing about the helmets. My favorite part of that was the behind the scenes of, like, the people on the production line, and there's this guy who's wearing cut up tube socks going all the way up his arm as, like, arm protection from whatever he was spraying on these helmets.
Oh, what the hell? I didn't know.
It was
I'm
held
sure
on
it
by duct tape.
That's amazing.
Surely he's still alive, so. Good Lord.
So the next piece of safety equipment we're going to talk about is, well, not so much safety equipment, but fire safety. And, you know, it starts off this clip with a bunch of slow motion shots of, like, cars crashing and on fire. And we talk to Phil Parsons, who kind of goes through his fire suit and whatnot. And, you know, there's a clip of the death of Fireball Roberts, who ironically died in a ball of flames at Charlotte. His death led to the development of the fuel cell, which they kind of show in detail as to how that works. And then
you used the word bladder way too much in that segment.
Well, I mean, that's part of the fuel system, like the bladder. You know, it's one of those things that it's a weird word, but once you hear it enough, you get used to it.
Maybe I just didn't like the way the guy was saying it.
Yes. Yeah, I get that. I feel you. real quick, a great Dave Dudley song about Fireball Roberts, too, to sort of throw back to an episode from last season where we're talking about racing songs. Fireball Roll to Seven, classic trucking song. So
listen to that. Check it out. Nice. One funny thing that I caught and just found very bizarre. So Phil is going through his fire suit and explaining the materials used, and he gets on the topic of asbestos, like asbestos being a fire retardant, and he talks about how they put that in the floorboards of their cars, which I didn't know that. I guess you know, I the only thing I know about asbestos is, you know, it's toxic and cancer causing, and you hear about it getting pulled out of old buildings and shit. I didn't realize it was used in race cars though, so that was interesting.
Well, it's an incredible material, just when it breaks apart and the fibers can get stuck in your lung, and that's what caused lung cancer. But you know, when you're putting in race cars that get smashed into the fence, I'm sure some of these guys probably didn't fare so well after a few of those accidents. But yeah, it was common back in those days.
Next couple segments are all about Buick. First one being about Oscar, which was Buick's on-site computer-aided research system that they brought to tracks. You know, this was
such
long
a tight acronym. I love that shit.
Yeah, you guys got to realize this was long before everybody had a personal computer, before the internet, before technology like this existed in every single garage. So I forget how they said they had to do it, but it seemed like every few minutes they had to get off the track, pull the data, and then get back on, which seems like a pretty arduous process to go through all day long. But it was interesting. The only funny thing to note is the one mechanic that they're interviewing pretty much throughout the whole segment, each time you see him, there's more and more sweat dripping down his face, which, you know, was gross, but it is what it is. And you see Ron Bouchard also. He's the one who's doing the testing. And
hell yeah, you do.
Ron, he's got a great 80s haircut going. He was another looker out there.
Ron Bouchard is a legend up here in New England, and you get a chance to see one of those 47 cars at Thompson and at a lot of the classic events and sort of vintage races they have here. That car still exists, and you can go lay hands on it and take a look at it. And I bought my Volkswagen from Ron Bouchard, Nissan.
No shit.
Yeah, so he's a big dealer guy. A little museum at the place up in Lemonster. So if you're looking for cars, you can stop in and see a modified or two. But that guy is he's a high holy character up here in New England racing for sure.
There's actually a follower of mine that it's some dude in Europe that he built like a replica Ron Bouchard Buick out of a stock Buick. Don't ask me how that got over to Europe, but he brings it to car shows and stuff. And the couple times I've had merchandise from that car, he buys it immediately. So Ron's got a super fan out there in Europe somewhere.
Yeah, that's weird. But yeah. Also a great book about Ron Bouchard that I have to recommend. You get it from Coastal 181. Great purveyor of racing books, especially with the New England shit. But anytime I get to see Ron Bouchard's name mentioned here, because he's not a forgotten character necessarily in Winston Cup history, but he had a few moments where he shined, particularly that Talladega win he had. That was something else. So always good to see Ron.
Next up from Buick, we get a look into their V6 plant. Now, I real quick, in 2024, I mean, Buick is still around as a brand, and at this point, it's a luxury grandpa style brand, more or less. But you know, it's interesting to watch and think about Buick as a brand having such a strong presence in motorsports, not just in stock cars, but I mean, they had that motor that won, I don't know how many poles in Indy. It didn't last. The motor always blew up, but it was fast.
Fastest shit in the world. Yeah, those Buick engines, which eventually became the Menard program at Indy, they were serious, serious pieces of equipment. So fast.
But this is just a look into the V6 plant. Now, while I knew Busch cars, you know, in the 90s ran V6s, I guess I didn't realize that the V6 was a thing that only came around, I guess, in like the late late 80s. This V6, this was NASCAR. Buick's goal was to get this motor as fast and as strong as a V8 motor. That's like the one thing that they talk about in this video. You know, the one mechanic was like, by 1990, 95, we think we can have V6s with V8 power. And one of the guys explaining the factory itself had a real nice hair helmet. And it, I never learned his name. So. And now here is my favorite segment. Next up, this is one of those color pieces that I don't even know how they do it today. But in 1985, I mean, yeah, NASCAR had a track out in California, but that was pretty much it. There wasn't really a whole lot of stuff. I mean, Phoenix wasn't around yet. Vegas obviously wasn't around.
This is an interesting parallel to us going to the Clash this weekend, because they used to start the NASCAR season at Riverside. So Daytona wasn't always the season opener. In fact, Riverside was for many, many years, and it was a road course at that. So
yep. NASCAR is not incredibly known on the in Venice Beach, and Steve Burns goes to
probably the last place.
Steve Burns goes to the boardwalk of Venice Beach to ask what people think of NASCAR and motorsports, and you get a real wild cast of characters in this video. The first guy is like probably the one you think of as a stereotypical NASCAR fan, like just this old grumpy looking, looks like ex-military guy, and he's like, yeah, I'm familiar with it. And then you see like
so golden
yes
so gold
there's a like a blue-haired wrestler girl that she has a bunch of different wild things to say.
I want to figure out who the hell that is.
Kat Bundy.
She looks like
a little bit. There's another younger blonde girl that doesn't know much about racing, but they interview a few random people. But the they keep going back to the first old guy. The next time they show him, he talks about he mentions Cale Yarbrough and Richard Petty, but then he asks Steve Byrne, who won the last race? Terry Labonte. Never heard of him. So he doesn't really follow the sport that strong. I mean, Terry won the title the year before.
Yeah, he was
so.
the current champion, yeah. Terry Labonte.
Then he starts pretending to play a trumpet, like just blowing his face, like playing air trumpet, and then he interprets the song that he played as a congratulatory song to Terry Labonte for winning the race. And
amazing. I hope Terry has a CDR copy of that that he plays in his basement.
Then they go from the boardwalk to Dodger Stadium, where Tommy Lasorda has some nice things to say about NASCAR. And then once again, back to our old guy who has to get going to eat some milk and cookies at home. That's what he tells Steve.
It's a sign off. That's great.
Yep. So again, that's my favorite. I would say watch the Wendell Scott, then this, if you only are going to pick two.
Just such a young, green Steve Burns out there. And
another great outfit from Steve.
Seriously. Yeah.
So, I guess I would say after the technical segment of the show, this is kind of the comic relief segment. So we go from the beach to we go to a crew chief go-kart race.
This is my one B here. Yeah, so I loved the whatever his name was, the segment from earlier. This is also a close second for my favorite.
Yeah, for sure.
They talked to a few different crew chiefs, and Chocolate being one of them. He mentions that this is like a fairly common thing when there's like a go-kart track.
They don't call him Chocolate, though.
This was before he was Chocolate.
It was pre-Chocolate, yeah.
Well, we'll get into it in the pit crew segment, but I mean, this was the Flying Aces weren't even really a thing yet. I mean, he was still, that whole team was still kind of emerging as to what they were going to be.
That's true. Yeah.
Regardless, fun little clip. I mean, again, nothing really too exciting, but it's funny, a little clip of a go-kart race.
More Dan Elliott.
I was going to say that was the segment where I got to agree with you. He is the good-looking Elliott.
He's handsome. Yeah. He's the Casey Kane of 1985.
Yeah, there were not many young studs in NASCAR in 85, so yeah.
Well, once you hit age 20, you looked like you were 50, no matter what. This is how it was, and all that cigarette smoke, I guess. I don't know.
There's also a lot of gold chains in this segment.
Lots
I don't know
of gold
if anyone
chains.
Else noticed that.
Lots of gold chains. But the commentary on that was hilarious. You know, they're really hamming it up, treating it like a serious Winston Cup race. Mm-hmm. And it's just these guys sliding around on a wet go-kart track. It's so fun. No helmets, yeah. You know. It's not a typical trip to K1 by any means, mm-hmm. but.
Well, these particular carts, you don't have to wear helmets for them. Like these ones.
No, so five horsepower, yeah.
Yeah. So this next segment, I think, I wouldn't put it as my favorite. I think it was probably the most interesting. And I don't know. I really enjoyed this next segment. And once again, you don't get introduced to who this reporter is, but I do learn that his name is Mike. And throughout the series, like, he's the pit reporter, like the at race pit reporter for all these episodes. But, he gets to be a crewman on the number 10 experimental team for DieGuard. I mean, they had two teams at the time, and this was the third team that this was their debut race. This was the car that eventually Greg Sachs would win in, cheated to all hell a year later at Talladega.
Well, that's the thing that's kind of missing from NASCAR these days is the R&D car, and I guess it sort of stuck around into the 2010s a little bit. They didn't quite call it that, or maybe they called it an R&D car because, they had nothing else to call it, and there was a heritage behind it, but, you know, this is before the days of there being a cap on how many cars you could run as a team.
Regardless, this... pit crew reporter, he tries out different positions and talks about each crewman's role, and Gary Nelson, that's his name, right? I'm forgetting names. He's the crew chief at the time. He is now like the NASCAR technical director or whatever. He assigns this reporter to be the catch can man, which is more or less the easiest job, but it does have a bit, you know, an added couple different roles. I mean, obviously you're catching the gas out of the back of the car. You also have to hand off the empty gas can to another crewman on the other side of the wall. And you also have to note his probably most important role was when the can came off the car, was to raise his hand so that the crew guys would drop the jack and the car would go off.
Yeah.
So he got to do that, and this is the days when, you know, pit stops for 30 seconds or whatever. He's out there in jeans. Nobody's wearing fire suits. It was cool. It's just I don't really have a whole lot else to say about this, but it was very neat. And to think that this was a thing that you could do just for fun, like, hey, you want to go out there and get behind the wall? Go for it. You know, like, this would fucking never happen today at all.
Well, I bet you half the people listening to this don't even know what a catch can is anymore, to be honest. Like, some of the younger listeners.
There was controversy about that a few months ago or a few weeks ago on Twitter, where I think like NASCAR or somebody like posted a photo of a catch can, and like nobody knew what the fuck it was, and like people were just getting roasted. And again, like if you weren't watching 20 years ago,
it's an obsolete. Well, the gas cans now have that little runoff hose that kind of feeds back into the, and you can see it happen, like that green ethanol going back up through into the can, and that replaced the catch can guy, because you don't need another fucking guy in jeans out there, you know, in these days. Hiring a college athlete to catch spilled fuel.
Well, one thing I'll note in modern times, that I actually wanted to talk about this last week, but I didn't. So for 2024, in the truck series, competitive pit stops are coming back for all the races. I know that was kind of a part-time thing. Like, some races, they didn't have them, but regular competitive pit stops are going to be back for the entire series this year. There was another rule change, though. The gas cans are going from 11 gallons to 9 gallons, and NASCAR did this because, unlike the Cup and Xfinity teams where you have these athletes and hired guns who are just there to literally just do the pit work, they wanted to put a lighter gas can so that they could have just a normal team member go and do that job, which I thought was interesting. It's a way to help the budget for those teams, because, I mean, there's a lot less money in trucks compared to the other two series. So just an interesting note that didn't get to mention last week.
I'm curious to see if it actually makes a difference in the competition or if it helps at all. I know it's a lot less weight, but, I mean, they're still going to be hiring the guys with the air guns, you know, they're still hiring like Stuart Haas pit crews and Joe Gibbs pit crews and all that. Like, that's still going to be a big piece of the budget. And I'm curious to see if, you know, dropping it by 2 gallons actually helps, but I guess we'll see.
Yeah. And speaking of, pit stops, we go to the first ever Unical Pit Crew Championship, which, you know, Ashley and I got to see the return of that last year at North Wilkesboro, which is really cool. Yeah.
Loved that. Best part of the whole fucking event, in my opinion, besides the Kyle Larson win.
But there's really not a whole lot to explain as to what's going on here. I mean, all it is just footage of teams doing their pit stops, and they explain how they can, you know, lose time, you know. But the winner, of course, was Dale Earnhardt and the Flying Aces team, who are not yet the Flying Aces, but their winning time was like 29-something seconds, which...
Right, that blew my fucking mind, because what, like 10 years later, they were down to like 16, 17 seconds.
Something like that. I want to say when I started watching in like 92, 93, they were around 18, you know?
Yeah.
And now they're, what, 12, 13 seconds tops usually.
That's
so.
A huge amount to shave off in less than 10 years.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
But again, I mean, guys were not really moving that fast. You know, you can go
not
back and watch
jeans.
Those old pit stops. Yeah, they're all wearing jeans and shit.
High-waisted Wranglers. You can't move in them.
Yeah. So this is cool. And then again, circling back to the beginning of the video,
also real quick, Dick Trickle driving in that previous segment in that number 10 car.
Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned that. Briefly, but they finished eighth in that race too. And yeah, circling back, you know, again, 85 was Bill Elliott's year, even though he didn't win the title. It was the year he won the Winston Million, and the last segment kind of documents that a little bit. You know, that same interview from the beginning of the video, Bill talks about, you know, they're still there in the driveway with cars going by, and Bill's talking about how the media was really making it difficult. Now, that interview was filmed just prior to the 600, which, you know, if he'd won that, would have been the million. You know, he ended up winning it in Darlington, but Bill was, and this is quote, he was aggravated and frustrated. Fluss, not frust. Fluss, L-F-L. He was frustrated.
I caught that too.
Because he was too busy doing media stuff to work on the car, and it took away from his preparation. So, what
it's
NASCAR
kind of a common
did?
Way to say that word around here.
Frustrated.
It is the dictionary. Well,
Denny Hamlin says it that way too, almost, but he just doesn't say an L or an R. He just says frustrated. Like, he cannot pronounce frustrated. It's so annoying to hear him do that. I think it's those teeth. That's what I think. He got those fake teeth a few years ago, and he still hasn't figured out how to use them. But anyways, so back to the Winston Million. To help Bill prepare for the race and his eventual win, NASCAR gave him like 6 pit stalls. The weekend of Darlington, they scheduled out the only time you could speak to him if you were in the press. He had 1 hour a day. You know, meeting in, you know, conference room or the fuck, the driver's meeting room at the track. That's the hour of the day that the press could talk to him. He had, like, armed guards around his trailer and his garage the whole time. Even though, you know, you see E.T. walking around the track looking for him later on. Bill apparently was bringing his steering wheel home every night. I don't know why you would fucking do that. That seems like a waste of time.
Lucky wheel.
And then
that's just just normal now, though, which is crazy. That's how all drivers do it. Take their bag home full of shit. It's crazy. Yeah.
And then there's some really cool drunk at the track fan footage. So just 30 great. Seconds of fans screaming. So and yeah, Bill wins. And that's it. That's the end of the video. I don't know if any more of these videos exist out there. I'm sure
if
they do. I hope they do too. I mean, I kind of want to send a message to NASCAR man and see where he got this and if more exist and if he's going to upload any, because I would love to see him. Yeah. Like, this type of shit is my wheelhouse all day long. So
I know we've said this on the show before, but NASCAR man is one of the finest purveyors of content, which is NASCAR or just racing related shit in general. Be sure and do yourself a favor and follow this guy. This is not the only cool thing he's posted. Everything he posts is worth a watch, and this is just a particularly good one. So
yep Yeah. So any final words, guys? I mean, I'm hoping you guys enjoyed this as much as I did. It sounds like you did.
I love this.
Yeah, it was just going to be an appeal to NASCAR man to post more of these, because the more of this that we can all see, the better. Because, again, a lot of this footage is brand new to me. I've been watching for a long time, and especially some of the more, like, lesser-known stuff, like, and even, like, the puff piece stuff, like, you're never going to see that. You're never going to see that again. And it takes a special kind of weirdo like us to enjoy it. I know all of you listening out there are those kind of weirdos, too. So yeah. Please post more, or at least show us where you can find it. NASCAR man, we love you very much.
Yep.
Yeah, I was born in 85, so it was a little nice little look into when I emerged into the world of what was going on in NASCAR. Yeah. It's interesting to see how far the technology's come, too.
Yeah, I was born in 84, so, yeah, I kind of had the same thought when I was
I'm
watching.
I'm older than both you motherfuckers? Jesus. I'm an 83 baby.
You were there to watch Wendell Scott get that win taken away, weren't you? Yeah. That's how old you are. Yeah.
That's the first video of the week of the season, and
so Brian said this is gonna piss us off, so I'm very curious to see.
I don't think it's gonna piss you. I think you're gonna be confused by it. So here we go. So this video, I'm gonna say this. Shout out to Mike from First 7-Inch Club. He sent me this video.
What's up, Mike?
Mike, let's say this. Mike and I have a similar passion for watching people do weird shit on the internet, and not just weird as in like grotesque and strange.
It is the Bud Dwyer video, isn't it?
No, see, that's not weird. That's I don't know how to describe that video, but it is not weird.
Google it, folks.
Yeah, you know, if somehow you don't know that video, watch that. So Mike and I, we love to watch weirdos do stuff on the internet, and this does include people who have hobbies and interesting ways to enjoy them. One thing that race fans, car fans, action figures, sports, whatever, figure collecting, diorama creating.
Do I need to sit down for this?
I'm scared. I don't know where this is going.
Wait, all right, fuck it. I'm just gonna spill it. So Mike sent me this video. I was aware that this was a thing in the NASCAR diecast collecting world, and I've even seen some like RC monster truck videos like this, but there are some people out there that make stop motion videos or stop motion races with diecast cars. So Mike found a video, and he was pissed off when he sent it to me. He's like, did you know about this and not tell me? And I was like vaguely aware of it, but I'd not seen this clip. But he sent me it's a 20-minute video, and it's a mock race at Port Royal Speedway with 25 sprint cars. It's titled Outlaw versus Posse Showdown. These are some of the stars of the World Outlaws versus some of the PA Posse. It's a 20-minute stop-motion race. It's all the heats, qualifiers,
all that
shit.
Let me guess, the Posse just whoops their asses, huh?
I haven't watched the whole thing. I wanted to wait until after we talk about it. I just kind of skimmed through it to see what it was all about.
Fucking Pennsylvania, man.
So, yeah, we're going to watch a stop-motion die-cast sprint car race next week. So that'll be on the Video of the Week playlist.
I'm not as mad as I thought I'd be.
Well, I was definitely playing up to be worse. You know, there are many layers and many different genres and ways to display your motorsports fandom, and this is one of those ways, and we're going to watch it and talk about it. So check the Video of the Week playlist after you listen to this show.
And a sprint car one at that. I've never seen that. Yeah. That's new to me. Yeah. I've seen all the, you know, there's that kid who built a, he might even be a kid. He could be my age, but he built that whole, speedway. Was it called Barron
Speedway, yeah. It's kinda, that's the one I knew of, yeah.
I wish at 10 years old I had that setup. That would have been fucking awesome.
Oh god, yeah. I mean,
can you imagine?
I had a little, like, my living room, I had a trial more or less that would go, like, my couch was the back stretch and the TV was one corner, there was a tape case that was the start finish line, and then the recliner was the other corner. So But that was just on the carpet. I didn't have no dime or ammo like this. But
yeah, I
had the, I did have the Days of Thunder playset, which was kind of similar, but that thing was only like 2 feet long, and you know.
Yeah, if you had a round rug with like rings on it as a child, you had a
mine was
speed
a rug.
Rug.
Yeah,
I had a big. My parents. I didn't have nothing when I was a fucking kid. It was all my parents' stuff. But my parents had this giant square rug that had that border around it. So I just had Indianapolis Motor Speedway because it was square, you know, and
yeah.
Real tough apex for guys to make, but it didn't make a difference when I was 10 years old. So,
so yeah, that'll. I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about
I'm
that.
Excited
I'm really,
now.
Really excited. So.
I'm just glad it's only 20 minutes, so I think it'll be fun.
Of course, posses versus outlaws. Fucking, of course it is.
So. That leads us to the Clash. We talked a little bit about the beginning at the beginning of the show, and you know, this weekend everybody in NASCAR will be there, along with the NASCAR Mexico Series.
Very cool.
I don't really know what to say about this. I mean, I'm excited to watch, excited to bet on racing again. I don't see myself winning a few hundred dollars like I did last year because I'm not getting any of those bonus bets. But I'll be placing the bets. Hopefully, I win something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think? It's the Clash. We kind of know what we're getting into. Yeah. You know, I'm just excited to see NASCAR on track
again.
Yeah,
I'm just
glad
racing's back.
Yeah, that's.
I'm kind of curious to watch the Mexico race. I don't really know anything about it. I think Suarez is in it, right?
Yep. The Mexico series is fun. Those guys get after it, so that'll be cool to see. I don't really fucking care. You know, it's not a real race. It's an exhibition. I think exhibition races are kind of stupid, and I don't like the all-star race really either. You know, I think it's super gimmicky, and I feel like if we're going to be going to a facility, let's make it a real race. I know it's a unpopular opinion, but I don't see why the Cup Series can't just fucking run at the Coliseum as a regular race. I know it'd be different points and all that, but they do that same shit for Daytona and other tracks too, where not everybody fits. So I don't know. It's just I would rather see this be a short track race on the schedule and just let him do it that way. Because like, starting the season off in California for a non-points race and we're going to go spend a bunch of money at Daytona, it just seems kind of silly. But, of course, I'm going to watch. It's a good chance for Ryan Preece to win. You get to see a lot of the guys who don't have a lot of money or speed put on a show. And I'm very much looking forward to it. So,
kind of curious to see Harvick's new role in the booth as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. It's his first time up there in a Cup broadcast. So that'll be cool to see.
Yep. And when Machine Gun Kelly plays, that'll be my time to go outside and shotgun a beer too.
That's exactly what it is, and I will be calling each other. Catch it live on Instagram, folks. But yeah, I don't care about the Clash. I don't even care if they ever do it again. I'd love to see him go to like a short track in Florida. Keep it close to the vest, you know. Maybe, and I know they can't do the little bull ring on the backstretch since the grandstands aren't there anymore. Like they used to do for the modifieds and K&N series and all that, but I don't know. It just seems like a lot of effort.
That and the fact that, like, you know, at least when the Busch Clash was a thing, you actually had to do something to qualify for the fucking race, and now it's just like, oh.
It's just a second all-star race now, which, again, like, I don't care about the exhibitions. I'm going to watch it, you know.
Yeah,
I'm absolutely going to watch it and yell at it and spend money on it. It is what it is, but I just don't really see the point, especially when the first race of the season is the fucking Daytona 500. Like, I don't see what else do you need to get ready for the upcoming season other than the biggest race of the year. So I don't know. It just makes not a lot of sense to me. Going to California makes sense. Racing in the Coliseum makes sense. Doing this stadium thing makes sense to me, but just like the positioning of it and what it is, I just don't really fully understand. But whatever, I'm still going to watch it, so I guess my opinion is null and void to the folks at NASCAR. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, you have to think about where they're doing it. I mean, this race isn't to get people like us to fly out. It's to get people
to
just drive in, you know? So.
Sure. I just don't see why that can't be a points race, that's all. And I know there's a lot of reasons, but I feel like, you know, we could make that happen. NASCAR could make that happen. And it would be cool. And it would be no less of a farce than Chicago was, which ended up being a good race. So you never know. I don't know.
Yeah. It could happen. I mean, I think this Coliseum experiment, regardless of it being a all-star race in L.A., I think it proves that you can do this in other stadiums. So who knows? It could lead to something down the line.
But to kick off the season, I don't know, man.
Yeah. Well, regardless, we'll all be watching it. We'll all be talking about it, and we'll be here next week to talk about it. As always, you can follow us on Instagram at meetmeatapplebees and on Twitter at meetmeatdebees, which, again, don't really use much more, but I will fight with you if you want.
Yes, he will.
Just tweet me.
He's got that dog in him.
He's fighting on his personal account. He's...
Yes, yes, yes. Anyways, as always, I am Speedway Screens on all the things. And speedwaytsj.etsy.com is the store. True love, where can they buy your shit?
I'm on the internet somewhere. Yeah.
Have you changed your name yet?
No, still Snake Mountain. True love. Still. Just gonna stay that way.
Steel.
It's fun.
Oh, man. Rob Motes underscore unofficial on Instagram. My band is called These Wild Plains. We're actually playing a little acoustic show this weekend, so all you Connecticut motherfuckers can come out and see us this Friday
night.
Bring
your bongos?
No, I'm going to sit on a stool and get drunk and sing like five songs while my band does all the heavy lifting. It's exactly what I've always wanted. But we're going to be at the Stomping Ground in Putnam on Friday, February 2nd. I don't know how much it costs. It's a cheap show. And that's a nice little spot, too. There's a great antique store right across the street I look forward to going to. Nice. Yeah, Putnam's a nice place. That's our first little foray back into the world. And then we'll be announcing some tour dates soon. Also, real quick, I meant to mention this during the short track segment, but if any of you are interested in New England Modified Racing or the NASCAR Modified Tour, I've talked about it a lot on this show. RaceDayCT.com just posted a really excellent series of interviews with people concerning the state of the sport, car counts, the schedule, et cetera. It's a really interesting window into the short track world up here and the NASCAR Modified Tour. And it kind of pulls the curtain back on a lot of other things in the short track world, in my opinion. So that's definitely worth checking out, racedayct.com. All kinds of guys getting interviewed, Doug Kobe, all them. And also, real quick, Tommy Baldwin has announced, this is actually a few weeks ago, but he announced that he is cancer-free. So that's good news.
Good news.
Nice. But yeah, These Wild Plains, Friday night, Putnam, Connecticut. Come out or don't. I'll be there sitting on a stool drunk. So, your choice. My choice has been made.
Cool. All right, folks. Thank you again for joining us at Applebee's. And we'll be here again next week to talk to you again. Take care.